CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 67, with Arthur Cummings, the future of refractive surgery, both corneal and lenticular. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I have a very special guest, my dear friend, Dr. Arthur Cummings, or I should say Mr. Cummings, as they refer to you there in Ireland. Arthur, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Uday. Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. It's what a privilege.
Yeah, I've enjoyed seeing you. Actually, recently, I've seen you in a couple of different countries. I saw you in Brazil and in Rio at the Brazilian cataract refractive meeting. And then I saw you again in Prague, Czech Republic, at the ACOS meeting. And tell me about your involvement in this. You're obviously a world traveler, and I know you were president of ACOS, which is AECOS, American European Congress of Ophthalmic Surgery.
Exactly. Yeah, I started attending that meeting in 2001 in Aspen. It used to be called the Aspen AES meeting, and it changed at some point to ACOS, and it was then ACOS. And at some point, Europe joined in, sort of 2014, I think, 10 years ago, and that's when it became AECOS. And I've been to, in the last 22 years of the Aspen meeting, it's probably 15. Wow. I've never been to one Deer Valley. I've made a commitment to go next year, and I haven't missed a European meeting since inception in 2014. Yeah, they're amazing meetings. Just like you, I love the fact that it's not only ophthalmologists. You know, it's such a diverse group, and you get diverse thought, and it takes you places you wouldn't otherwise go.
For sure. So, yeah, I used to also go to the AERS meeting long, long ago, which is the Aspen Invitational Refractive Symposium with Dave Delaney. Exactly. And then you're right, that kind of transformed. This was my very first ACOS Europe meeting in Prague. And boy, I had such a good time. Now, I'll tell you, I left with one bit of sadness, which is, there's so many amazing products and technologies and implants that we just don't have in the USA. And when I hear about them on the podium in Europe, I feel a little twinge of jealousy.
It's changing though, don't you think so, with EU MDR? And I think it's changing. And the FDA has become a lot more agile. So I think that's changing. I think the one thing I like about ACOS in the US is that you get some free time in the day, where the European program is so busy. You go to these great cities and you never get time to really explore them.
Yeah, I had to like carve out some time to actually enjoy a little bit. But you're right. In the U.S. meeting, I'll be in Deer Valley in just a couple of weeks. And that's a fantastic meeting because they finish and with enough time that you can spend the afternoon riding a mountain bike or going for a hike, et cetera. Or if the Aspen meeting, it's in the wintertime, you can obviously go skiing or snowboarding.
Exactly. Yeah, it's great. It's a lovely way to, you've got time also to, you know, to mix with colleagues and friends. It's not only work.
Right. I think that's probably the most important part. I mean, just sitting with you and having dinner in Rio de Janeiro is like, I probably learned more from that than any podium presentation.
That's exactly right, Uday. I've seen that, you know, there's a meeting this year that started this year for the first time ever. It was in Italy with Francesca Caronis and Amanda Caronis, and they called it Ophthalpreneurs. When someone asked me what that meeting's about, I thought about it and I said exactly what you did now. I said, that meeting's about the things we discuss in the corridors at other meetings. The things we're really interested in, but we don't get to speak about them. They're not on the podium. Yeah, so it's fascinating. It's great to spend time doing those things. That's where we learn.
When you get right, we learn from each other.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's a fantastic meeting. I had Shiraz Dai on the podcast and learned about that meeting. Ophthalmopreneurs, like kind of ophthalmology and entrepreneur kind of combined.
Exactly. So it apparently started some years ago with orthopreneurs. The orthopedic guys are doing it. And it's worked really well. And Amanda met this guy, Matthew Ray Scott, and they had the ideation, and it came about. And the very first meeting, as Shiraz would have told you, was super busy, super successful, super busy, really a great meeting. And there's one next year in Sicily.
I'll have to go.
You got to go. You're going to love it.
I'll have to go. Yeah, this year I couldn't make it. My calendar, you know, I'm doing 21 countries this year, so it's a little bit hectic, hard to fit that in. But I'll definitely put a priority on my next year's agenda. So what were some of the highlights from the meeting that you really enjoyed? And the entrepreneurial kind of, you know,
focus. ACOS now in Prague.
Yeah, either ACOS Prague or the Ophthalmopreneurs. What were kind of some of the pros?
A lot of the things are just making practice better. So, you know, when you've been around a long time, as you know, we keep on learning. I don't know how you still keep on learning. You're exposed to so much. But we keep on learning. But the parts that really make a difference to our day-to-day are the things you learn that are not necessarily medical. The ways of doing things more simply or more easily or more, you know, just more in a more compliant way, or making doing business with your clinic easier. So making life for patients easier. all those sorts of things. So the whole digitalization process has been a huge part of our practice since COVID.
Right.
So when COVID hit, you know, we've had an electronic medical record since 1999, but we only used it for the refractive component. So pre-op refraction, post-op refraction, it's a great way of working out nomograms and looking at aconstants and things. But it was just that that context. And then a year before COVID struck, for whatever reason, we've been meaning to do it for so long, we decided to go completely digital.
Wow.
And have no more records. And incredibly, within a year, COVID had struck. And so that came in super handy. We could do remote teleconsultations and those kinds of things by accessing the files digitally. And since then, we've never looked back. I don't think there's any system that's perfect, but we found a system that works for us and has made life easier. And then as time goes on, you find ways of refining everything digital and making it better. So it's just a process of learning all the time. And I mean, the rate that things are changing in the digital space is off the charts. You really have to find something you like and stay with it until you see something that's much better.
Now, are you doing now kind of virtual consultations online with patients, at least initially, and then having them come in for, you know, measurements or topography, tomography, biometry?
So we did that during COVID. But the way it's transitional now is what I learned recently. This is one of the big learnings for me. And you and I probably, I'm sure you've experienced this 1,000 times, is how many people have met you and say to you, we finally met in person. And you're saying, no, we've met many times before. And they remind you and say, no, every time we met before was virtually. This is our first time in person, I'm telling you. So what's happened is our brains, the amygdala, no longer has the ability to recall if you saw someone in real or virtually. So what we started doing is using video to our advantage. So we make so many videos in the clinic just for patients. So even though my team would do the workups, we've got a team of optometrists and they do the workups, all the conversations that are happening are pre-recorded videos explaining LASIK or PRK or the consent forms all done digitally. And so by the time the patient gets to see you, they think they've met you 100 times before. Meantime, they might see you for the first time in person. So what we do now is we have a setup where anyone who's seen the optometric team, everyone's given the option of saying, do you want to meet Dr. Cummings? And most say, no, we've met him before because they've seen all the videos. But those who do have the choice of either coming in person or doing it virtually. So we do maybe 10 virtual calls a week, speaking to patients who might be, you know, far away from you in remote parts of the country. And then you do a virtual call. But it's not a big part of people now coming into the clinic again.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I mean, I email patients a video ahead of time. So when they book the appointment, we get their email address on the phone. We say, okay, let me send you a video to watch. And so it kind of, they get to know me because I narrate the whole video. You see my face, my voice. And the nice part is I don't have to repeat the same conversation in a day 40 times. They've already seen it at home.
Absolutely. You know, Uday, if you just think about your videos you've had on advanced technology IOLs, you know, those can be quite complicated. So can you imagine trying to give someone in the course of a couple of hours their time in the clinic, do the assessment, figure out what you want to do, then go through the consent, and they leave you saying, I've spent 2.5 hours, I've been bombarded with information, but
right,
I don't understand anything. So if all of that's done in video and they get it before the time, they can watch it as many times as they like.
That's
key. They can watch it with a friend, with a mom or a dad or a colleague. So it really, videos changed our lives without a doubt.
Yeah, I think we're going to get to the point too with like AI videos. Already now I'm seeing online where you can send a text, take a picture of yourself, and it'll animate a face. It'll animate your face and you with your voice of the text you just typed.
Oh my word.
Yeah. So this is coming down. Now there are going to be some crazy deep fakes coming too, I'm sure of it. But the neat part here is being able to have like, you know, patients in general ask about the same questions. 80% of the questions that are asked are asked by a lot of people. So to have kind of pre-recorded things for that is very helpful. And then you could even set it up as almost a conversation using an AI bot.
Exactly. Exactly right. We've got an AI bot now that it's absolutely brilliant. We've had it for the last 6 weeks. We've had AI bots before that sort of access the internet. And you can get information that the bot might give, which might be different to what you're going to say. So the one we have currently, it only has a fixed data set and we provide it. So it's our website. It's all our consent forms. It's all our information leaflets. And I put about 30 articles in there that we adhere to. And now when it gives an answer, it gives an answer that comes from that data set. So it's like we're giving the answer. It's super cool.
Now that's critically important. So that's a little subtlety, but so important, which is the AI only has access to the data set that you gave to the AI.
Exactly. And my concern with it being broader, like it was before, is that you've just said it yourself a moment ago, is there's so much fake news. How does AI at this point know what's fake and what's not? So if you can limit the boundaries of that data, it comes up with unbelievably clever answers, I tell you. Sometimes I think, is that right? And then, it's right.
Wow, that's kind of neat. No, I like that idea, because a famous example that was in the news recently was, AI, ChatGPT 4.0 was asked, like, okay, the pepperonis on my pizza keep sliding off. How do I make them adhere? And the answer that came up with was glue, which is like, okay, you don't quite get it, but.
Exactly. Now, if that came off your website, it wouldn't say glue.
Right. So that's why I like it. Giving that fixed data set of, this is your library, use this. And then from that, you can give your AI answers. But I think we're going to head that way. And then instead of just having text on a screen, literally, I've seen examples now where I send just a still shot on my face. It'll animate my face. And it'll even emulate the tone of my voice.
That's incredible. Yeah, that's amazing.
I think, it's a brave new world. I think that the people like you and me who are solidly mid-career are going to enjoy this kind of on the way out. But the young generation, it's a brave new world. It's amazing. You're so fortunate.
Yeah, they are. They are. You know, another thing that I've been thinking about recently and been exposed to a little bit is that at the moment, there are more ophthalmologists retiring than there are young ophthalmologists coming into training.
Yeah.
So, we're going to have to become more efficient. And so, I mean, I know when you do surgery, you're busy the entire day and you're doing a lot of surgery, but we're going to have to do more. Otherwise, we're going to get further and further behind in terms of just getting cataracts done, let alone other vision correction procedures.
Right. But we're coming to, I'm involved with a company now. There's my financial disclosure, Horizon Surgical Systems here in Los Angeles. It's automated robotic cataract surgery.
Wow. And how far is that down the line?
Who knows? Time will tell. But the amazing part is, I think you may get to the point in the future where your routine cataract cases, let's say 7 millimeter or more dilation and, 2 to 3 to maybe 4 plus nuclear sclerosis, and otherwise a normal case, those can be done by a robot supervised by a surgeon, a human surgeon. And then us human surgeons, we're going to be left with like the really hard, small pupil, loose zonules, intubescent white cat. You only get the hard cases.
Yeah, that's what's happening in the UK at the moment. They're not in Ireland so much, but in the UK, that there's so many private companies that have come into the market that are now doing cataracts for the NHS, or the National Health Service. And so it's good politically because their waiting list gets shorter, but they do all the straightforward cases. And so the hospitals, the universities have all the tricky cases, and now the residents can't really learn on them. They're too tricky. So the consultants have to do them. And so there's quite an issue with training. So I think what's going to happen is the companies doing the big volume of surgery now, they're going to have to start providing teaching to young ophthalmologists.
Oh, wow. What a paradigm shift.
Isn't that bizarre? In a very short space of time, So Ireland, since we've been here, which is 26 years, has been sort of half the population have health insurance and half use the public service. It's been like that for a long time. But in the UK, 26 years ago, maybe 5% of all work was done privately. But now more than half the cataracts in the UK are done privately.
Oh my goodness, what a growth. I didn't realize.
Yeah, not all by people like you and me, but by companies doing it. So coming in, doing big numbers at a time and, set up specifically to take care of long waiting lists. But they're private. They're private health companies who bring in private consultants.
So the health company then contracts with the NHS directly, and the patients are still covered under the NHS plan. It's not like they're paying out of pocket or private insurance.
I think so. I'm not 100% sure, but that's what I think. That's what I understand, is those companies get paid by the NHS. And sometimes for the NHS, it's even more cost effective to outsource it rather than to do it themselves.
I mean, it makes me wonder, are the days for boutique surgeons like you and me, are days a little bit numbered?
I don't think so. You think about it yourself. I mean, there are loads of restaurants under a particular banner, McDonald's, for lack of a better example. Sure. But even though they're there and they're all over the place, now they work, you still like going to places that are not necessarily McDonald's, you know, just because they're different and they're more exclusive. Well,
better quality, higher level of service. I mean, basically what we're providing.
Exactly. I think that's going to grow. I mean, if I see how people are spending money on handbags and shoes and, you know, good holidays, that part of the market's just got stronger and stronger. And I've read about, it's not happening in Europe as far as I know, but in the US, this concierge medicine. Are you involved in that?
So a lot of the primary care doctors here in the west side of Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, et cetera, are all concierge doctors now. And what that means is, for a primary care doctor, they require a payment from the patient of, let's say, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year in addition to your health insurance to be seen. And then you have this direct access to the doctor. Then the doctor limits the practice to, you know, so many patients.
And those doctors are busy, as far as I understand.
Very. A lot of them, you can't even become one of their clients anymore, one of their patients. They're full. They're closed.
Yeah, so I don't think our days are numbered. I don't think so. I think probably quite the opposite, that if you're part of a big chain where everything looks the same, sure, that's got efficiencies and it's got its place, no question. But I think there are enough people out there who want to see you. They want to see you. They like your style. They like what you do. They like what you stand for. And you're quite unique. And they want to see you. So I don't think it's going to go away.
I think you're right. I think there's a market for all of this.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's kind of neat, though. As now I'm solidly mid-career, I could do any of it. You could put me in like a corporate setup and say, here, today you can do 100 cataracts, no problem. Or I could do a more boutique practice and you're going to do this. Or I can do the super challenging ones. Today, we only have 10 cases for you, but every one is really difficult. And so I could just kind of go, I'm happy to have the variety.
Yeah.
But I think we're in ophthalmology. I think there's somewhat of a move towards like plastic surgery. I have two sisters who are plastic surgeons, who are brilliant, and I learn a lot from them. But I think in LA, it's like patients are just expecting, like, yes, paying for plastic surgery. And now dermatology has kind of gone that way, where there's essentially no dermatologist going to take any insurance, you'll pay out of pocket. And I think ophthalmology is kind of headed that way as well. Speaking of orthopedics, there's an ortho group here in Los Angeles where they may take your insurance for the facility fee and everything else, but the surgeon fee is like X amount out of pocket, which is often as much as, you know, a small car.
Yeah, big money. Exactly. It's exactly right. And I think there's a differentiation now. You know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you and I we only practiced medicine and people came in with pathology. Right. And now it's changed, where a lot of our patients don't have pathology. They just want performance. They want to see better. They want to function better. They want a different lifestyle. They want to enjoy their retirement in HD. They want to, you know, they want to enjoy their life. And it's all a performance related issue. And so that changes the game, because not only must you do the procedure well, but you also have this additional metric of, did you meet their expectations? And I think that's going to become a bigger and bigger part. I mean, look at the growth of, the growth of ATILs in terms of presbyopic correction has been quite slow. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a lot to do with the doctors ourselves. You know, we've taken a while to get on, but once people start doing them, they just do bigger and bigger and bigger numbers, the surgeons themselves. And as more and more doctors become accustomed to using them and using the tools, you know, to predict better outcomes, like, you don't do it for patients with heavy floaters or with corneal irregularities. You know, once those things are all established, the results of those procedures are really, really good. And I think that's going to fuel the market more.
Yeah, it's only going to get better. We'll only have more and more technologies. I'm certainly hopeful that in the next few years, we'll have a truly accommodating IOL, especially hopefully within 20 years when I need cataract surgery, I want an accommodating IOL. But I think, yeah, the technologies keep improving and advancing. And yeah, the tougher burden though on us is we have to be able to deliver not just the great refractive outcome, but actually a great patient experience.
Exactly. Absolutely right.
And that can be one of the challenges. Like in my clinic, I have one of my challenges. I try to challenge myself that no patient will ever sit for more than 5 minutes.
Wow. While we're in the clinic?
No, when the check-in at the beginning. Don't leave them waiting in a waiting room, which
right,
is...
Right.
So what I'm doing is, yes, I mean, even if I'm a little bit behind here, you know what? And the patient's been sitting there 4.5 minutes, you know what? Why don't you take the patient? Let's give me an autorefractor. Do me a NIDEC OPD scan. Do some, so at least engage with the patient something. That's extra data I can use that I'll... Don't just have them sit.
Just keep things going. Keep them ticking over.
Right. I really aim to give the same care that I want to receive. And I don't want to sit and wait. And I want to be treated right. And I want a great experience. And so we really try hard to like put ourselves in the patient's shoes.
I think that's a very good recipe when you're trying to do what you would for yourself or for your nearest and dearest. Then it's going to, you know, turn out to be a good experience for them. I remember in the Y&I meeting, maybe just before COVID, you were speaking about LensGen, I think, about
the company was,
Are you still involved with that?
I am to a degree. I'm not there. The LensGen Juveen accommodating IOL is now undergoing FDA trials.
Right.
There are 4 sites, I think, in the US. I'm not one of the sites. So right. I'm not actually involved in the trial. Though patients, because they see my videos online, email me, potential patients email me all the time asking about it. But I think we're going to head towards leaving a big capsular bag. Don't collapse the capsular bag with a very thin IOL, keeping the bag open. I think we're going to give some sort of curvature changing IOL is the only way to do it. Moving an IOL front to back in the eye from posterior to anterior to get a little myopic shift is really not the answer because you can't get enough. We just have to mimic a young human lens, which is increasing the lenticular curvature.
So it's interesting. I've heard an alternative viewpoint too, that maybe the lens is going to work best is in fact not in the bag, but in the sulcus. And Jorge Alio has a very interesting lens he's using called the Echo lens. I haven't used the Echo lens. And it's almost like 2 flat triangles. And when you have accommodation, the 2 lenses move over one another. And as they move over one another, they get more central power. And apparently it works quite well with cardiac range. So
I love it. Listen, I want more horses in the race to true accommodation. So if you've got 10 different IOL designs, I want to see all 10 of them. Let me learn from all of them. So I don't think there's going to be just one winner in this horse race. I think there are going to be many. And that's only going to benefit us, and it's going to benefit our patients.
Absolutely. Exactly right. What did I see? I think at the moment, they're like something like 2 billion people on the planet who presbyopic.
Yeah, my only saving grace is, thank goodness, on mine is 2.
And you just take them off.
Yeah, my near vision is spectacular.
Yeah, I was also -2 for a long time. And then when I got varifocals for the first time, I used to take them off, and I got varifocals, and they drove me crazy. And I then looked at blended vision, and I did 1 eye to 0, 1 eye to -150, and that worked incredibly. I like that a lot more than varifocals. So that's worked really well and stood me in good stead for the last 15 years, probably not 15, 12, 13 years.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, but I can feel it's starting to go.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Don't worry, those accommodating IOLs are coming. We'll be good. Now, tell me about your career path. You've had an amazing and very different career path. You weren't always in Ireland.
No. So I trained in South Africa and had no idea I was going to be in Ireland at any point. When I trained in a school that was very strong on retina. So we all became very good retinal surgeons. And when I qualified, I was doing retinal surgery all the time. I was doing 10 DR cases a week, which in Pretoria, where I lived, was a lot of cases. But we were all doing LASIK as well, and we were all doing cataracts. We are trained in Pretoria, and I think to a large degree in South Africa back then, your training was very service-orientated. And the academics, you almost had to fend for yourself, and because it was all about service. It was such a demand. And so what I used to do every year, because I was so deep into retina, I would spend some time abroad. At a retinal unit, and in 1997 spent a month in the UK. So spent a couple of weeks in Moorfields and a couple other places, and it was their best summer in 30 years. And my previous experience of UK was sort of shades of grey, and this summer was colourful. Jeez, there was colour everywhere, and my family were with me, and they said we could live here. And when I understood the system better, I said, yeah, it's never going to work. I like private medicine. And there you're going to be a consultant for a very long time before you get a private list. But things change, obviously. And within 6 weeks, I saw an advert in a South African medical journal for a clinic in Ireland in refractive. And 30 years ago, refractive wasn't very strong in the UK. So I thought, wow, this is weird. So I rang the guy and he invited me to come visit. We came to visit 6 weeks later. We came in the middle of November where it's dark at 4:30. It was raining the 4 days we were here. But we couldn't believe that the vibrancy and people out and about all the time. Where I grew up in Pretoria, well, not when I grew up, but when I started working in Pretoria, is you wouldn't be out on the streets after dark. You know, it's just dangerous. So you'd be in your home and you'd commute from your home to wherever you're going. That's it. You're not on the streets. Yeah, people on the streets. And so what we figured out is I was doing a lot of LASIK in South Africa, but very much like a technician, doing a refraction, doing the tests we could do, doing the procedure. And when a patient comes back, just checking their vision. And once they get to 20/20, you stop checking. You don't even do a refraction. So I thought, let me spend some time in a refractive clinic that's doing refractive only. And so that's when I joined this clinic as a fellow in 1998. And after 18 months, when it was time to go back, my wife just said she really enjoyed the lifestyle here. She enjoyed the fact that the kids could walk to school and cycle to school. And so we stayed on. And I didn't do any retina in that 18 months. And in fact, for the next 8 years, didn't do a cataract. Wow. So it's quite competitive. And even in the private sector, there was just no space for me. So I was doing LASIK only. And I think, Uday, had I known it would have worked out this way, I mightn't have stayed on. I did LASIK only. But the funny thing happened is a new hospital opened, the one where I work now. My clinic's adjacent to this hospital. And they opened up. At that point, they were part of Johns Hopkins. And then within 6 months, they transferred to some other US groups like Triad and UPMC. They're now owned by an Australian group. But anyway, they opened a new hospital and they had place for me. So I started in cataracts again. And when I started in cataracts, I was really disappointed with our refractive outcomes because I'd become so LASIK mindset. I said, why is it so bad? Especially on previous LASIK patients. So then we started doing some projects on trying to do different ways of calculating IOL power without formulae. So we developed this product, my colleague and I. We went through, we got some support from the state, and we had to do all the science we had to do with local Irish universities. So it took us a little while to get through the science. Once we had proof of concept, we did a clinical trial, and we had one of the big corporates sponsor the clinical trial with a right of first refusal. The trial worked out really well, so the results were spectacular with no formulas. And so they acquired the technology. But it got me big into the space of cataract surgery is 100% refractive surgery.
For sure.
Yeah. So if we see cataract patients afterwards who need spectacles, we're disappointed. It's not what we were aiming for. We wanted to get them out of glasses.
Yeah. I mean, some of the data you bring up is that, you know, for cataract refractive surgery, like LASIK, we're used to about 95% of patients are plus or minus a half diopter of target.
Exactly. Whereas
typically in the U.S., for really great cataract surgeons, it's maybe 80% plus. So that means one out of five patients is a miss.
Exactly. And you know, when you have your own lens, that plus or minus half that you're out, you can still compensate for some of the error. But when you have a fixed lens inside the eye and it's a diffractive multifocal, you've got to be on target to get the best from that lens. So, you know, the bar is being raised all the time. When we were in Brazil, I bumped into Warren Hill, and he said he's actually changing his entire RBF formula. He's rewriting it because of how much AI has learned in the last little while. He says the new version will be significantly more accurate. So I think with IOL surgery now, we're going to start looking at the same kind of results as LASIK.
Yeah, I think we're going to get there, which is really neat and obviously important for when we have, you know, these newer technology IOLs.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Michael Morocco, I'm sure you know Michael Morocco.
Sure.
And Michael, he asked a question one day to a user group, and he said, what do you think the repeatability is of a refraction, the refractive process, to within plus or minus a half, and over the course of a day, same patient? And everyone said, surely 100%. And he said, no. It's only 92% of refractions will actually get you to plus or minus a half. And that's examiner, as well as the same examiner with one patient the whole day. So even refraction per se is not that accurate. And we're getting sort of 92 to 94% of people with the standard treatment around that number. We're getting plus or minus a half. So the limit is no longer the devices we're using. It's more about what we're putting into the machines. Right. So we started recently doing ray tracing LASIK.
So instead of using a subjective refraction, using biometric measure data.
Yes, exactly. But the key thing is, so no matter how you currently customize a treatment, whether it's topography guided or asphericity guided or wavefront guided, you're using one customization process for the procedure.
Sure.
With ray tracing, what happens is the very first thing you do is you measure the eye, including biometry, and the software creates an avatar of the eye. So now the eye is your eye with your actual length, your curvature, your anterior chamber depth, your lens thickness, the whole lot. Whereas all the other procedures we do, once the calculation is, or once the calculation starts, it's done on Gullstrand's eye model. And Gullstrand's eye model is always 24 millimeters long, right, and 40 feet off the corneal curvature. And by definition, that eye is pretty close to emmetropia, while the patients we're treating are not emmetropic. So no matter how clever the diagnostics are, when you apply them to Gullstrand's model, you lose some translation. So now it gets translated to your avatar. And then it does the treatment in silico. So it does the treatment virtually on this virtual eye. So it's planned the treatment with all the information it has. It's got wavefront, it's got, and that's to 1/100th of a diopter. It's got the curvature of the cornea with, what is it, 25,000 data points as opposed to 1K or 2Ks. And then it's got axial length with knowing exactly where, along the line of sight anyway, where the lens is, front and back. And then because it has all that information, it can recreate the lens shape. So now it recreates the lens shape and has your avatar. But it does the treatment. If that treatment was perfectly planned, then all the rays land up on the fovea. So they invariably don't. And then what it does is it looks at the rays that have not landed up on the fovea and ray traces them backwards through the vitreous, the lens, the cornea, and on the spot it exits your cornea, makes the adjustment to get it right on the fovea. And it runs through this reiteration process. And we were involved in this trial in 2009, which was three different devices. And the calculation was 6 hours long, done in Zurich. Wow. 6 hours long. Now on the device, the test is getting the data in about 8 minutes. But on the laser, once you put it on the laser, I've never seen one yet take longer than a minute. Within a minute, it's done the whole thing, all the iterations, and wow, says, here's your treatment. And so the results there are spectacular. Chandra Bala in Australia, he's done 2,000 cases like this now. And he has, I'll give you the numbers now, 86%, I think, are 2016 and better, 100% are 2020, 86% are 2016, and 49% are 2012.
Wow.
So in,
that's
so,
like it's the retina limit almost, right?
Yeah. So once you start improving the input and the way the laser's thinking about it, the results can, they get, you know, better and better and better. And all that does is the IOL patients are saying, my LASIK friend's seeing better than me. So the bar, you know, the bar just keeps on going up.
Right. So then we have to apply the same technology for lenticular patients, for IOL patients in the future.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're a fan of the light adjustable lens, aren't you?
Well, that's an option too. But how about this, something even easier? Why don't you put an IOL in the eye, let it heal up, aim for a little minus, and then a month or two or three later, do this keratorefractive refractive procedure.
I love that idea, but now you're doing two procedures.
Well, that's okay. It's been for 2012 vision, I'll take it.
Yeah, especially a LASIK. I mean, the recovery is overnight.
Right. Or in the future, we'll have refractive index shaping where we'll be able to, yes, you know, use a femtosecond laser to adjust the power of any existing IOL in the eye and almost now, in perpetuity.
Now, that's interesting. That to me is very interesting that you don't have to adjust it. I did the LAL, and the biggest headache was how many patients were on target at the initially. And I don't want to do anything, nor do they. And then you've got to go through the process of locking in and so on.
Right.
So
I think it has its place. Yes. I just don't think it's for like every patient who walks in the door.
I don't think so.
But no, it's just, again, I always want more options, more technologies, more choices, more tools in my toolbox is what, how, the way I see it.
It keeps it fun, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's so interesting. I mean, you think I traveled all these meetings, all these countries. I learned at every one of them. And arguably, I learn way more than I teach.
I doubt that.
There's so many little tricks and pearls. Like, oh, I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I must say. And that's why you and I both like working with industry, too, because there you meet engineers and people who aren't necessarily ophthalmologists and thinking clinically only. And you get this huge, wide perspective on things, and you just think about things differently.
Oh yeah,
to me it makes it a lot of fun. You know, in South Africa, when I was working in this clinic in Pretoria, the senior partner was a super guy, very very skilled ophthalmologist. But he said to me one day, he said, you know, you're really enthusiastic and passionate. And I said, yeah, it's great, this is fabulous work. And he said, well, I'll speak to you in 10 years, you'll be bored stiff. And I sat back that evening and thought, no, that can't be. And, you know, my folks weren't wealthy people. They weren't poor, but they weren't wealthy. And they put us through college. We didn't have any loans for college and so on. And I thought to myself, I'm never going to let that happen, that they worked really hard to let us go to college.
Right.
And then we bored in 10 years. And so I always had it as part of my psyche. I don't ever want to get bored. And one of the nicest ways not to be bored is when everything you're doing has an additional implication. So you might be part of a study and you really want to see what that outcome looks like, or you're thinking about an accommodating IOL and you're looking at ways of measuring accommodation. But if everything you're doing always has an additional question, it keeps it interesting.
It does, for sure. I mean, people are sometimes surprised when I said I've done these tens of thousands of cataract surgeries, and they said, aren't you bored yet? And I said, no, I love it. In fact, if I travel too much and I miss an OR day, I kind of feel sad. I wish I was in the OR.
Jeez, you've been traveling this year.
Right. So, no, I think that's the neat part about this. I mean, if you find something you're passionate about, there's so many unanswered questions. You know, you do a surgery, like, you know what? What if I did this? What if this existed?
Yeah,
absolutely. So I think that's the neat part.
Yeah. It's fascinating. There are many of those things where if you look at the evolution of just laser vision correction, for argument's sake, starting with PRK and then going LASIK and then going lens field extraction, is if you today had none of those and all three suddenly became available, which one would rise to the top? You know, it's so difficult to, I mean, I sometimes hear people saying PRK is an awful procedure and it's had its time, but there are times for me when it's the only one that's going to work. Now, for repair work, it's a brilliant procedure in the right at the right time. It's interesting. I've asked myself that question a few times. If right now three people came out with these three procedures and ICL to make things even more complicated and said these are the ways we can correct vision, which one would naturally rise to the top if they're all starting off this the same playing field?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, at this point, I want all of them.
Exactly.
I don't want to be limited by just having one, but which will rise? I guess it depends on your patient population. If I'm in an area that's a younger population, maybe just like a LASIK or SMILE or keratorefractive procedure is going to be at the top. But if I'm like in my practice, Beverly Hills are not a lot of young people. The average home price is some gazillion nonsense, crazy. So my patients in general are much older. So I do far more IOL surgery than keratorefractive surgery.
So, you know, things have changed yet too. When I started out, well, for those 8 years, I only did LASIK. But IOLs now are probably half of what we do. And the interesting thing is LASIK surgery is quite, it sort of fluctuates with the economy. So when young people have money, they're doing LASIK. And LASIK's mostly for the younger generation. But IOLs are almost recession-proof. Cataracts are recession-proof. But IOLs, you know, most IOL patients we're treating are presbyopic. So they're 45 plus. Most of them are probably in their 50s already. And they've got some money. They are not paying mortgages necessarily anymore. Their kids might be out of college. And they want to have a better lifestyle. So they've got the money. So it's interesting when people speak about the demand of these procedures, how they fluctuate. I think it's got mostly to do with the demographics, what's happening in the demographics. Who at the moment has money, those who have money come and see you and have their eyes fixed, and those who don't come and see you at a later time.
Right. I think that's just about exactly what we see, is that in my patient population, a lot of patients in their 50s and 60s are doing refractive lens exchange. And then obviously 70 and beyond, you've already got lens opacities, you've got actual cataracts. But you're right, exactly. These patients aren't really worried about whatever the cost is. They just want to have the best, and they want to just be able to enjoy their life.
Exactly. And many of them find that the cost is actually not prohibitive at all. They think it's really good value. You know, I think you can have bilateral IOLs for a fraction of one knee replacement.
Right. I think also we're very helped by our dental colleagues who are brilliant, because like in Los Angeles, a single tooth for an implant costs the same as one refractive lens exchange with a premium lens. And you got like 32 teeth, or maybe if you had your wisdom teeth, about 28 teeth. So these dentists are absolute geniuses. And even the plastic surgeons, like, they figured out that, you know, these injections, the fillers, the neuromodulators, the Botox, these are like, patients are back every 3 months, 6 months. It's just like, they're like waitlist. There are plastic surgery clinics who don't have enough capacity. You can't get an appointment for 6 months or a year.
Incredible. I wonder if you heard the same comment that Sherif Madavi made at ACOS in Aspen 1 year, where he showed what LASIK numbers did after 08 when the crash came, and what aesthetic procedures did. And aesthetic didn't skip a beat, they just kept on climbing. And he made the comment where people would pay more to look good than to see good. You remember that?
You know, it's probably true. I'm in Los Angeles where, boy, believe me, that's like a big push here.
Again, but it's lifestyle, it's personal preference. And that's why I'm saying, can you imagine those same people going to a clinic with 100 branches or outlets versus a boutique place?
No, they want the boutique for sure. It's the same way they want. I learned something new, you know, in my clinic. My staff taught me. They said, did you see that woman's handbag? I don't know. I said, it was like a blue purse. And they said, no, doctor, it's a blue Hermes crocodile Birkin bag. And I didn't know what this was. I had to Google it. And then I realized that bag sells used for like $80,000 US for a purse, a used purse. It blew my absolute mind. But no, you have certainly you have that population who wants a boutique experience. But you know what? Even the ones who don't buy those crazy purses, I don't own any purses. But when I want to go out for a nice dinner, I don't want that chain restaurant. I want to go out to that really nice place and have a great experience. I'll pay extra. And I want that high level of service with that high level of food outcome. I want like the amazing food. And it's worth it.
Uday, there's another thing that's fascinating. It's pure psychology. And that is just that all of us figure if you're paying more for something, it's better quality. It's just what we figure. Mm-hmm. It's a psychology we can't get past. And I know in our prices are nothing like in LA, but the only way we could eventually differentiate in Ireland was based on price. Because our website never really spoke much about technology, but every other website of clinics doing refractive surgery would say the most experienced surgeon, the best technology, the best. So it's hard for someone looking to do refractive surgery, but they will say the same thing. They all look the same. They all say the same thing. But the one way you differentiate is by price. So the moment your price stands out, then people say, why is that? And there are very few who can keep on pushing their price up to create the fact that, or the impression that they are the leading light in the area. If you're not doing good work, you can't keep on pushing the price up. So then you sort of, it's a different model. It's sell them, stack them high and sell them cheap. You know what else I've learned recently, which I'd love to hear your opinion, is in the past, we used ICL surgery for patients who were outside the range of laser because we were getting great results with laser, really happy with it. But ICL's got its advantages, like there's dryness. You can treat patients who are outside the range of LASIK. But there's one that I'd never realized. So recently, people are speaking about doing ICL for lower numbers. So we started going to 8, 7, 6. We've now done a few at 3 and 4 if the patient really wants that. But here's the thing I never really copped onto. And that is, I've always thought the patients we see like LASIK and they like the things we do because they're permanent. But it turns out we see very few people. We see like 1 or 2% of the population who at any point are actively seeking vision correction. And the 98% who aren't coming in are not coming in because the results are permanent. So they're afraid that if you get a result you don't like, you've got a permanent unhappy situation. So when I speak to patients about ICL, and we're in the -4, -5 group now, and I'll say to them, look, you're going to get an equally good result with ICL as you will with laser, equally good. There'll be no difference for you. At -10, sure, there's a difference, but -4 and -5 for you, there's no difference. And I'll say, well, there is one difference. I can remove the ICL if I don't like it. I said, yeah, that's totally true. And they're saying, well, that for me is worth twice the cost. I'll pay the premium. I like the fact that I'm going to remove it. Well, I can remove it. And I'll say to them, well, in all the years we're doing this, we've actually never removed one for a patient that's unhappy. They said, I don't mind. I know I've got the choice to go back to where I was if I don't like it. That's quite powerful, don't you think?
I think that's brilliant. I think it's like, I really never really thought of it from that perspective. But I do admire Star Surgical for really advancing that ICL, the newer iterations from the US now with the Evo ICL. I don't work with that company. And as a consultant or anything, but I'm just admiring from the sidelines, like, wow, you're doing a great job. I even see on my, I'm scrolling through Reddit, the Reddit website, and I see ads for, because I must be doing so much ice stuff on the Google searches that I see ads for Evo ICL in my Reddit scroll. I'm like, wow, that's kind of progressive. I didn't think an ophthalmic company would kind of advertise on Reddit, but bless them. They're doing good things.
Incredible. Are you doing ICLs?
I am. Don't do a whole huge volume. Like I said, my population is, I'm 90%+ IOL.
Yeah.
So in the past, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I did more LASIK. Maybe, you know, almost equal numbers, but now I'm doing far more IOLs. And it's, to me, honestly, it's a more fun surgery. I like it. I like the challenge of it. And I get referred in Los Angeles. I get referred a lot of tough cases. And so that, like, I just saw yesterday the consult for this traumatic cataract. It's like, that's going to take a while. Let's put that at the end of the OR day. But I want the challenge. I want to enjoy it. The patient already has vitreous in the AC. So I'm like, okay, this will be fun.
So what do you have? I'm
more interested in that. LASIK is great, but you know, speaking of robots, there's a lot of LASIK that's pretty much automated, right? I go to my femto, I put a suction ring down. Once I have it lined up where I want, all I do is step on a pedal. I swing over to my excimer. Okay, I lift a flap. I have my, you know, my routine and the amount of time it takes and the room, the temperature and the humidity. And then the excimer does the ablation. It tracks the eye for me at 500 hertz. Okay, I put the flap down. So this, we're already probably 90% robotic on the you know, keratorefractive surgery.
Absolutely, absolutely. The few things you do are docking properly, and if you lose suction, knowing how to manage that, you know, quickly. And then with, no matter how good the trackers are, you still got to align the patient properly, because the trackers are tracking the pupil while the laser is treating the cornea, so you can still get misalignment.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, all the magic's happening with technology.
Right. So I think we're not quite there yet with cataracts. The robotic cataract surgery is still coming. But at this point, yeah, I love the challenge, the thinking through. And, you know, my big OR days are Mondays. So I always go Sunday nights. I go through my Sunday evenings. After dinner, I go through my lineup for the next day and kind of look at, think about all the cases. Like, oh, let me look at the pictures from that case and plan out what we're going to do. So I just still find so much fun in it. I like the mental challenge of, like, the puzzle, and then obviously the physical challenge of doing that tough surgery.
Yeah, you can see you're passionate about it. I mean, you have to be. If you don't have that kind of enjoyment, then like my friend said way back, you could get bored. But you'll never get bored.
Right. So, no, it's fantastic. So I have slowed down. One of the best advice I got a few years ago was someone very important to me, elderly person, said that his biggest regret in life was that he wasted his 50s and 60s working so much. For what? And when the person finally retires at 80 something, he lived another year and then passed on. And he says he never got to enjoy. So what? The bank account had a couple more, you know, little numbers. What's the difference? So then after that is when at 52, I retired from my professor duties 2 years ago. And now it's like I'm enjoying my practice, but I'm enjoying having a life. I'm enjoying traveling. And like you, I'm an empty nester. Kids are grown up. So it's just kind of fun to just really, you know what? I love ophthalmology. I love doing surgery. But I also want to love enjoying my life, especially because after age 50, we're all on the second half.
Absolutely right. And you know something? I mean, I've had so many people my age nowadays saying, our only currency is time. That's all you have.
Right.
And how do you spend that time? And you don't know what's ahead of you. You have no idea what's ahead of you, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we need to make sure that we spend enough time recharging the batteries and not just working, because you can sort of, in ophthalmology, you can if you want to, you can work all the time. There's enough work, and it's cool, it's fun, but I think you got to take time to recharge and just sit back and get a bit of perspective.
Yeah, I struggle with it actually a lot. In my 30s and probably at least half or more of my 40s, I was a complete workaholic. It was nonsensical. It was crazy.
I think it's the era too, though. You know, it's always easy to look back. I mean, right. I look back and I look at, in my clinic, a few people recently have got engaged, and the guys have been unbelievable. Their boyfriends or their fiancés now have been amazing in the way they propose. And I look back at my own proposal was so amateurish compared to what people are doing now.
The bar is much higher.
Oh, my word. If I look at how hands-on I was, I thought I was a hands-on father when the kids were younger. Compared to my son now with his kids, it's like, it's a paradigm shift. It's unbelievable. He, by the way, is one of your biggest fans. is a huge fan of yours. He's an amazing cataract surgeon and training here in Ireland 7 years of ophthalmology. And when people, you know, comment on his skills and how good he is, he says, Uday.
The cataract coach, there you go.
All 2000, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's been, and we're still keeping up with one video a day. I can't tell you how much work that is. That maybe I still am a workaholic because I'm still sticking to a new podcast every single week and a new video every single day. So it does add up, but
just a different kind of work. A different kind of
yeah,
work.
But I enjoy it. I learned so much. I see things like, I mean, today's video of the day is so interesting. It was a patient who had like loose zonular support, and then the surgeon saw that a little piece of nucleus went behind the posterior capsule. Well, then the question is, what do you do about it? And so this surgeon did some pars plana ports and took it out with a vitrector. But then I kind of posed the question to the audience, okay, what would you do? And I love to read all the comments because there's a whole spectrum of options what you can do here. So I kind of learned too. Some people say, no, I've had this exact patient many times. Don't worry, it'll dissolve in the cascade of inflammation. Other person says, no, I had a patient like this. They got chronic CME, macular edema. So to me, it's just great learning.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's amazing.
I can put a video up, and in the first couple of days, I can have thousands of ophthalmologists see it. Like in a week, 10,000 ophthalmologists, no problem at all.
How do you manage all the queries? You need an AI bot to do that for you.
I need to look into that. But you know, one of the tough things that I struggle with is how do I get someone else to edit a video for me? And that's tough because even if I hire a professional video editor, what do they know about capsular X's? They don't even know what the word means.
Exactly. But I'm just thinking, you know, you could have an amazing, you could have all your videos listened to by an AI chatbot. So it puts it down in script for you, transcribes it for you, and feed all of that information into a chatbot that is just, that's its information. You'll get an amazing resource there.
Oh, God, you're so right. I should think about that. Yeah, I just have the data set would be these 2,200 videos. And then you could have an AI bot trained on that, and then you could query it anything, and yes, get the answer from those.
And it'll say to you, Uday said on the 1st of March 2022, this is how this was managed, and this colleague said this on that day. You know, you'll get an incredible insight, a wealth of knowledge.
And I thank you for a brilliant idea, but now that's going to be so much more work.
You must subcontract it to someone.
I'm gonna have to contract that one. I'm gonna have to contract out, that's for sure, because I love the idea, it's fantastic.
It's just an amazing resource. Imagine anytime you want, you can just pop it into your website, ask Uday, boom, and it comes out with resolving the question on your data set, not on stuff that's happened outside there. And if it picks up a comment, there'll be context to it where you've said there's an array, some take it out right now, some wait. If the nucleus fragment's quite small, I'll watch it for a while. It might just dissolve. Yeah. It gives you perspective, but it will give you what people have done along the way.
Oh, that's a brilliant idea. Yeah, I'll certainly have to look into this. And then I can pair it with that AI bot face and my voice emulator. And so it'll...
And then you can be out of it permanently. You can be permanently traveling.
But then I'd miss the OR again.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's coming next for you? So you have a son who's going to be obviously an ophthalmologist. That's fantastic.
Yeah, he's working with me now. So he did a fellowship this year. He did two fellowships. He's in one in ocular plastics and he's doing one in refractive. So the refractive one ends now in the next month. So he's done a lot of LASIK, ICLs. He's a great cataract surgeon. He's done lens replacements. And then he's doing ocular plastics at the local academic hospital here. He goes in one day a week and he's a very gifted ocular plastic surgeon. So yeah, we're working together. I hope to work with him for the next, you know, if my health holds out, I'd like to work like I am now for the next 4 or 5 years, which is like flat out, and then start winding down. And I hope in 10 years' time to still do sort of one morning every second day, helping him with things, you know, but then spending more time on the things that my wife and I can do together. She's also worked pretty hard all her life. She's an audiologist, and she was on her own for 20 of the years here in Ireland. And then over the last few years, she's put together a big team. So she's got 8 audiologists now, and she only works, well, not only works, but she does 3 long days a week, but she's changing that to 2 days soon. And so you can sort of exit from clinical work not in one go, but sort of systematically over time.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think I'll do similar, just kind of slowly taper down to have the shift to find new balance.
Yes, but the thing you're going to need, and so am I going to need, because we've been so busy and active in so many ways, is as you taper from clinical, you need something else to start growing. So if you only had the concept of cataract coach now, it would be unbelievable. You'd grow beautifully, and you transition from being a clinician full-time to cataract coach taking off and then making that a real full-time thing. But you're doing two full-time jobs at the moment when you're running a big practice and doing a lot of surgery, and you making 2,000 videos in the last few years. So those are two big gigs. But you can probably carry on doing videos for forever once you're not busy clinically anymore.
Yeah, I mean, the amazing part is I used to feature at the beginning, all the videos were me operating because that's what I had. But then I started asking viewers, hey, send your video in. And I get now 30 to 50 videos sent to me a week.
Yeah, that's brilliant, Uday. That's great. That's how people learn. That's absolutely brilliant. That just shows you how collaboration is, and together we're stronger rather than, you know, you've got a massive knowledge, but it's still limited to your experience.
Right.
And that's why you still learn things from other people. And that goes for the same as us. I mean, how many LASIKs haven't I done? And I'll still see something and say, wow, I did not know that. I hadn't seen that before. I hadn't thought about it that way before.
Right. So, no, for sure.
You know, collectively and collaboratively, collectively, we know a lot about ophthalmology, all of us together. There's not much we don't know.
Right. No, I think that kind of group effort, the group mindset, the, you know, crowdsourcing of the knowledge is really a great way of going for the future here. And I think the young people, our young generation, are so lucky that you can learn. I'm happy if I can learn from my own mistakes, but the new generation, they're smarter than me. They can learn from mistakes of others. They can watch a video of a complication on their mobile phone in high def and play it back a few times and understand, oh, okay, that. And if they ever see that, now they know how to resolve it.
So, I mean, it must be so unbelievably fulfilling for you to know that what you've built there, that legacy, is going to go on for a long time to come. And they'll eventually be replaced as we use robotics to do the surgeries and who knows what. But I mean, that whole mindset of I can put a tool in your hands that if you get into trouble, is a way of getting out. I mean, that's amazing.
Right. That's no, you know, I got to give credit actually to Bob Osher. I spoke with him at a meeting in Connecticut a couple weeks ago. He's like the godfather of cataract videos, obviously, going back decades. But I still remember when I was a resident, finding those VHS tapes of his and learning how to do all these things. But yeah, I think your point was great, which is just it's all collaborative learning, and we all get better together, which is just so fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I think we're blessed to be, I'm sure you feel the same way. We're just so blessed every day to be an ophthalmologist. So that's why I don't want to fully retire ever. I kind of want to do, I got to do something in ophthalmology. It's all I know.
And making videos.
Yeah, basically. But even the videos, they're not that good. They're not that wow. They're cataract videos. So, but it's fun stuff. Well, Arthur, what a pleasure talking to you today. Learned so much about your path and your passions and, wow, if you meet Arthur at a meeting, come up and say hi to him. You will have a fantastic conversation, and you'll learn those secrets in the hallway that are not always on the podium.
Hey, thanks, Uday. Always a pleasure chatting to you, man.
Thank you. Good. And I want to remind our viewers and listeners, remember, every single week we have a brand new podcast on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast. Plus, every day, of course, there's a brand new cataractcoach.com video on YouTube and all the other social media sites. We will catch you next time.